Our state constitution hits a pretty significant milestone in 2022. The 50th anniversary of the document as we know it is this year, and in this edition of the Voices of Montana podcast, we take an interesting dive into its history, how it was first drafted in 1889, some of the influential figures behind it, how it was reimagined through the Constitutional Convention of 1972, and just some of the things that make it so unique for the Treasure State. Our guests in this episode include Chuck Johnson and Evan Barrett. Chuck previously reported for Lee Newspapers, the Great Falls Tribune, the Associated Press, and the Bozeman Daily Chronicle, while Evan has spent time working with Montana Governors Forrest Anderson, Tom Judge, and Brian Schweitzer throughout his career, and is now a member of the Constitutional Convention Celebration Committee. Basically, we've got two experts on the state of Montana, and they just about know it all. They even take some time to answer some callers' questions about the document, so it's just packed with interesting information and tidbits about Montana, and I have a feeling this is just the first of more to come on this particular topic. Enjoy.
Evan, how you doing today?
Hey, I'm great, thank you. A little chilly, but this is Montana.
Yeah, I know it. And Chuck, how about yourself?
Pretty good, Tom, and you?
I'm doing okay. Chuck Johnson, if I didn't say it out loud, I think we recognize his work with Lee Newspapers, also worked with the Great Falls Tribune, worked with AP. Both these guys, born and raised in Montana. And Chuck, since I'm talking with you, I'll start with you. As a Montanan, when you got this assignment to cover the 1972 Constitutional Convention, what were your first thoughts going into this?
Well, I was 23 years old, and I'd worked for the Associated Press the previous summer as a vacation relief person. And then the end of the summer, my boss, Paul Freeman, said, "We'd like you to cover the Constitutional Convention. Would you be interested?" And I thought, boy, that sounds like fun. And I was a graduate student and dropped out of school for that quarter. And it was really interesting for a lot of reasons, but one of which was there was a great deal of work done in preparation of this Constitution. And maybe we can get into that later. And a lot of interest statewide spurred by various groups, probably no more so than by the League of Women Voters, which had lobbied for the call. But maybe I'm getting ahead of myself. Evan can probably give us the background, but we had difficulty adopting a constitution, didn't we, Evan?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, our history on constitutions, Chuck and Tom, is, we started, believe it or not, think about the guy on the horse in front of the Capitol, the big statue. That's Thomas Francis Marr waving his sword. And he was the first territorial governor of Montana. He was a super patriot from Ireland and kind of a wild and crazy guy. And he was named the territorial governor of Montana when we first were a territory. And being as audacious as he was, when he got to Helena, he decided we ought to be a state right away, and he put together a constitutional convention, and they wrote the constitution, and they shifted upstream or downstream all the way to St. Louis, where they got it off the boat, and we're going to get it printed, and it got lost. I think somebody may have been having little libations, but nonetheless, it disappeared forever, and that was an 1866 effort. But in 1884, Montana thought it was going to become a state. And so they did call the constitutional territorial governor called a convention. And there were 45 delegates at that convention. And by the way, as was at the time the way it was, all men, all white Anglo-Saxon men that were in Helena, Montana to write that convention, and primarily representing the powerful economic interests of the time. And the president of that convention was none other than William A. Clark, the nefarious Copper King from Butte. And they wrote a constitution and submitted it to Congress saying, "Hey, we're ready to be a state." And Congress totally ignored them. they weren't ready to have us be a state yet. But 5 years later, in 1889, there was a group of states in the Northwest who entered statehood together, and Montana was one of those. And so we had another convention, and in 1889, there were 75 delegates, all men, and president of the convention again was W.A. Clark, and they fixed up the Constitution and sent it to Congress, and we were made a state. And so we lived with that for 83 years. and it was written and the way things were in the time. It was very voluminous, a lot of detail, a lot of extraneous language, and a lot of provisions in it that were very protective of things like mining. For example, you couldn't, it actually constitutionally disallowed the taxation of the proceeds of mining. I mean, can you imagine that? So there was a lot of special stuff in it, but Montana had that for 83 years, starting in 1889. And it was kind of interesting because by the time, you know, under that constitution, and coincidentally, I think, in a way, because of the power of the economic interests of the Anaconda Company out of Butte, we became known as a corporate colony. John Gunther, writing his great book of Inside USA back a while back, I guess that would have been in 1947, a big hit book. He wrote, and I'll quote him, he said, Anaconda, a company aptly named, has a constrictor-like grip on much of what goes on, and that Montana is the nearest thing to a corporate colony of any American state.
Interesting.
Extraordinarily interesting thing to have said in a national, I mean, the top seller of the year in books at the time. And 10 years later, and it's worth noting that as the copper collar we operated under, which was the context for needing a new constitution, included the fact that prior to Chuck's time, the Minneconda Company owned every major daily newspaper in the state of Montana, with the exception of the Great Falls Tribune. And so The Economist in 1957 said that Montana newspaper readers are here's the quote, worse informed about their own affairs than the inhabitants of almost any other state. So the part of a context of the demand for a new constitution was we had an old one, and the old one was archaic and was tilted toward the powerful interests. It had an ineffective executive. It had a weak governor that could hardly govern, and it had a secretive legislature. And people saw the way it was happening after World War II, when the guys came back from war and got the GI Bill and got educated and started looking at things. And then in 59, we had they sold the newspapers, and Lee newspapers came in. And suddenly we started finding news we hadn't heard before. And America and Montanans got kind of aware of the limitations of their government and the problems of their government. And that was a fire that was smoldering and then kind of blew up into a conflagration of citizen activity with the League of Women Voters. And out of all that stuff, that led us to a constitution. We had a legislative council for the first time in those days. And the legislative council actually did a research project on the Constitution, and they found out that fully 33% of the 85 sections of the Constitution should be repealed.
Interesting.
The bipartisan legislative council. And so out of that council study, they put it up to a vote. The League of Women Voters, of course, was pushing it very hard, and they put it up for a vote. Should we have a constitutional convention? And 65% of the people said yes. And meanwhile, Chuck mentioned it, there was a Constitutional Revision Commission which started studying and had these absolutely amazing young staff people who ended up literally writing books of details about what other states were doing with their constitutions, and built an intellectual framework for the delegates to act on. So that would have been in the 1970 election, while they were had the question on the ballot, should we have a convention? They were preparing for the convention, and the election was 65%. So suddenly the 1971 legislature had the job of putting together the convention, and they created a thing called the Constitutional Convention Commission, which set up the rules and the election and everything like that, and set up all their procedures and what happened. And I'll wrap this up pretty quickly here. They ended up having a election that followed the guidelines of the it was in September of that year, and following the guidelines of the existing legislative districts at that time, they elected 100 delegates. They had an August convention. They had, you know, there were 550 people filed to run for that.
Evan, 550. Stand by. I want to get a question here from Chuck, too. It's Evan Barrett, a member of the executive committee for the Constitutional Convention Celebration Committee. We'll talk about some of those events, and we'll have more interviews throughout the year leading up to that, too. Evan, by the way, Thomas Maher is one of the few governors that he didn't work for. Forrest Anderson, Tom Judge, Brian Schweitzer, Pat Williams, and John Melcher as well in Congress. A long and distinguished career. Chuck, I want to ask you, and we probably, we got just like maybe about a minute and a half in this segment. How long did the Copper Kings influence, last in Montana politics? Because as a 72 constitution was written and put before the voters, there was still some of that influence in opposition.
There was, although it's hard to document, Tom. We didn't have campaign finance reports in those days, but, I may be getting ahead of myself, but the voters narrowly, by 2,500 votes, voted to ratify the Constitution proposed by the convention, and the vote was in the June 1972 primary. So it squeaked by the skin of its teeth, and there's some reasons. Maybe we can get to those later, but it was still the company, Montana Power and Anaconda, still had influence, but the sale of the papers, I think, definitely weakened that influence for the Anaconda Company. And you had a general reform movement kind of a building in Montana. It was a time of change. You had, the women's movement. You had a budding environmental movement. You had a strong labor movement.
All right, stand by, Chuck. Let's come on back and then explore where Montana was at in 1972 then at the rewriting of this Constitution. Back with more in a bit.
It's called a whiteout, and it requires caution. Snowplows create a cloud of snow that limits visibility for drivers following too closely, oncoming vehicles, and sometimes even the snowplow driver. Be patient. Plows maneuver slowly to clear the roads. As you approach a snowplow, slow down and give the plow driver room to work. Remember, don't crowd the plow. A safety message from AAA Mountain West and the Montana Department of Transportation.
I want to go back to that question. Is Evan, thanks for setting up where we were and some of the criticisms of that early Constitution. Chuck, who were we in 1972 when we rewrote or reimagined our state constitution?
Well, we were a pretty divided state, Tom. The House in the previous legislative sessions was controlled by Republicans, the Senate by Democrats, and you know, you had at the time, of course, the Anaconda Company was fully operational in Montana, so you had a lot of labor union members in Butte, Anaconda, and Great Falls, and of course those are gone now, and you had a pretty strong farmers union movement that was a Democratic, mostly voted Democratic. You had the strong corporations like Montana Power, Anaconda. You had the Montana Farm Bureau Federation, which was a leading conservative group. Another one that was maybe more active in politics then than now, in actual practical politics, was the Montana Taxpayers Association. So you had some strong groups on both sides,
and a pretty divided
state.
I was going to say, don't forget the stock growers.
Stock growers, they remain one of the strongest group in politics and certainly were there.
Evan, as Chuck had said, this Constitution, and there's a lot of places we can go, so we'll jump around an awful lot, but I noticed it as well, and why did it just squeak by? It passed narrowly, 2,500 votes, that's statewide, and then was upheld narrowly by the Montana Supreme Court, 3-2. What were some of the reasons for that, do you think?
Well, it's an interesting contrast to know that 65% of the people wanted to call a constitution because they could see the weaknesses and some of the problems. But after there was a campaign, it was after it was written and there was a campaign, suddenly we were down to 2,500 votes. My analysis of it at a personal level is that the Constitution represented a significant shift in power from the power that was granted to the larger corporations and the larger economic interests in the 1889 Constitution to an empowerment of people in the 72 Constitution. So it was written with great openness and great participation. And for example, we have the only constitutional provision in the United States that guarantees the people the right to participate in government decision-making before the decisions are made. That, along with open government, open records, there was a lot of stuff that empowered people. And, of course, as you empowered the people, you were disempowering the economic interests that had power for 83 years. So they went after the Constitution after it was passed. It was up for a vote, and they opposed it vigorously. And before it was all over, because of that vigorous opposition, we were down to a 2,500-vote margin. It was essentially the urban areas passed it, and the rural areas were against it. There was an exception. But that's my rationale for why it got tight.
Chuck, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd agree with that. One decision that the delegates made, Tom, was to put three side issues on the ballot along with the ratification question. And the side issues were to abolish or keep the death penalty, and voters hardly rejected that, getting rid of the death penalty. Another was whether to go to a one-house or unicameral legislature, and voters rejected that. The one that passed overwhelmingly by over 60% was whether to authorize the legislature to legalize gambling as it saw fit. The 1889 Constitution banned the legislature from doing that, but of course we know that was widely ignored in parts of the state, and we did have at times pretty open gambling. But I think that was a smart issue, because if those any of those first two issues, the banning the death penalty or going to a one-house legislature, had been in the Constitution, I think it likely would have gone down. But one thing I'd like to mention, Tom, is it was an unusual group of delegates. I think a lot of legislators, when they voted to put it on the ballot, thought, well, you know, we meet in odd number years. This will be an even number year. We'll run for the Constitutional Convention, too. More of the same. And so it went to the Montana Supreme Court, and the court held that current office holders, whether state office holders, statewide office holders, or legislators, county commissioners, city council or commission members, mayors, could not run because they'd be holding two offices at the same time. So what you got was a really unusual group of people. Many of them had never run for office before. Some had been in the past, but you had a real mixture. You had 24 lawyers, 20 farmers and ranchers, 17 business owners, 13 educators, 11 what they called housewives then, five ministers or priests, four people who worked in the media, some three or four college professors, two bankers, a beekeeper, a radio DJ, and a retired FBI agent. So you had a pretty darned interesting mix of people. There were no Native Americans at the Constitutional Convention, and that's in part because of the way the legislature set up the legislative election districts in the past. They ran countywide rather than in single-member districts, but it was a pretty good mix of people, and they chose to downplay partisanship in a couple ways. They shared power. Leo Graybill, a Great Falls Democrat who'd run a couple of times for Congress, was elected as the president of the Constitutional Convention, but they insisted on having a vice president who was a Republican, John Toole from Missoula, and the other offices were split. The committee chairs were divided by party, and the chair and the vice chairs were of opposite parties. And one of the things I thought was a great idea, they chose to sit alphabetically A through Z, instead of having the Republicans on one side and the Democrats on the other, as our legislature does. So there was partisanship at times, but it was definitely less than there is during a legislature. And I think that was key to its success.
Let me throw in on that, because we haven't mentioned this number, that after the election in November of 1971, the special election, there were 58 Democratic delegates, 36 Republican, and 6 independents. But in spite of the Democrats being in strong control, Leo Grable had the visionary sense to engage with Marshall Murray and Jim Felt and some of the key Republicans and did what Chuck just said. Said, let's share this responsibility. Let's go against this thing being highly partisan. And they created a very nonpartisan, bipartisan atmosphere in spite of having almost 60% of the delegates. And, you know, the delegates who remain today, and there are only 12 of the 100 still alive, they look upon that alphabetical seating as so key that they said within a few working days, they no longer considered the person sitting next to them a Democrat or Republican. They were just a fellow Montanan.
And that I appreciate more so as I think I get, I guess, more and more experienced in politics, how relationships can be real key. Evan Barrett is with us, Chuck Johnson as well. You know, our phones are open. Got one line, 866-627-5483 or 781-627-5483. I know both these guys would love to have you throw in on this with questions or comments. Got one here, Chuck, and this is addressed to you, maybe a bit out of the box, but Pat from Helena says, how did the Great Falls Tribune avoid ownership from Anaconda like all the others?
Well, it was owned for much of that time by the Warden family, a longtime family in Great Falls. Although I would say this, and this is kind of interesting, I worked for the Tribune, and we always heard it was the only independent paper, but in the early days when Clark and Daly were having their big feud, Clark occasionally would buy the Great Falls Tribune for an election cycle and then sell it back to the Wardens afterwards. But the Tribune had a tradition of being an independent voice, whereas the Anaconda Company or its predecessor owned most of the other dailies, all the other major dailies, I should say.
Oh, gosh. That's I'm still laughing about that one. That's actually, you know, from a business standpoint, you know, not a bad idea, right?
And not unique to Montana. I mean, you had people like William Randolph Hearst, who was playing a role in national politics, to own different Hearst papers, and it was not uncommon. Joseph Dixon, who was a congressman and later a governor, at one point was the publisher and owner of the Missoulian, I believe, wasn't he, Evan?
Yeah, I believe so. You know, there is a book written about this, I mean, about the captive press in Montana, and, you know, it talks about in the earliest days before they consolidated on all this, they had rival newspapers. Clark had a paper, Daly had a paper, you know, they were all, but eventually, as they consolidated the copper industry into one company, it then absorbed and created all this purchase of all these papers. And it was a pretty powerful interest. What he asserts in his book is that it isn't so much that they put false information in the papers, it's what they didn't cover.
Go ahead, Chuck.
The book is called Copper Chorus by Dennis Swybold, a former editor of the Bozeman Chronicle, who's now a journalism professor at the University of Montana. And it's a great read about early Montana politics and how the various papers were bought and the influence they had. I'd highly recommend it to anyone.
Going to take a break. I'm a minute away from it. Chris, I've got you on the line, and I don't have time for your question here, so stand by. We're with Evan Barrett and Chuck Johnson. Of course, Chuck, you know, as a longtime Lee newspaper reporter in Montana, been covering, how many sessions have you covered, Chuck? Like almost 30?
22, and 22. Many, many special sessions beyond that.
Yeah. I've always appreciated and respected your work, and Evan Barrett as well. He is a long time, economic development, education, but also governmental affairs person from the state of Montana, member of this committee. We'll talk about some of these events. I want to get to this preamble here as well, because there's been a lot said about it. We, the people of Montana, grateful to God for the quiet beauty of our state, the grandeur of our mountains, the vastness of our rolling plains, and desiring to improve the quality of life, equality of opportunity, and to secure the blessings of liberty for this and future generations, do ordain and establish this Constitution.
Voices of Montana continues right after this.
Agriculture is more than just planting and harvesting. It's a science, a business, and an art. Hello, I'm Joe Lackman, your Montana FFA State President from Hysham. FFA is not just for students in production, farming, and ranching. Many of our members aspire to be teachers, doctors, scientists, business owners, and more. FFA helps members develop their own unique talents and explore their interests in a broad range of careers. Go to MontanaFFA.org to learn more.
Thanks to Farmers Union Insurance for supporting FFA and this message.
Today, as we're talking about this Constitutional Convention celebration, want to get some information out there about what these events are going to be down the road, but still a lot to discuss here when it comes to the history behind this, the necessity of it, the good, the bad, and the ugly, and want to get your phone calls as well. Both Chuck Johnson, Evan Barrett with us here. We'd love to hear from you at 866-627-5483. You can text us a message at 781-627-5483. Let's get to this line so we can open it up. Chris, thank you for calling and hanging on from Columbia Falls. You're on the air here with Chuck and Evan.
Yeah, this is directed at all of you. So I've lived here since 1975, and I've done business, hunted, fished, and been over the east side and talked to farmers and all. But here's one insidious problem that's arose from allowing us to be neglectful. I'm looking at the Article 2 in the Constitution of Montana, and it sounds a lot like our country's constitution as well. And it deals mostly about declaration of rights and who has these rights. And it talks about a pattern and a diplomacy that we should adhere to. Now, who adheres to it? There's a lot of hunters and fishermen who don't get involved, but they obey the laws, and some don't, but they obey the laws. They love Montana and people who are farmers, and you know, they'll let you on your land if you talk to them respectfully and you treat them correctly. But there is a problem that's developed over the years, and it's the extreme groups, the environmental groups, who don't or interpret this Declaration of Rights to themselves. And they're backed by some rogue individuals, judges, and other things who seem to circumvent this. Now, what you need is somebody, well, I'll give credit to the governor now. He seems to be standing up to the to these groups and doing what is correctly adhered to in the Montana Article 2. That gives you the power, the people the power. It tells you what you can do and what you can't do, and that's what we should adhere to, and not allow these groups to have some sort of special force, you know, when it comes to logging or anything else. They seem to just block it.
Okay, Chris.
And then it goes on and litigates for a long time.
It does,
and this
yes.
This is crazy.
Thank you. You know, I appreciate that. I want to open up this line, and it's really a good question. That's been some of the criticism about this Constitution, is that it has been I'll let Chuck and Evan just answer that question as well. The good, the bad, and the ugly. Chuck, we'll start with you on this one of our 1972 Constitution.
Well, the Bill of Rights is seen by its advocates as one of the best around. It has a explicit right to privacy, which I don't think many constitutions do. It's got a right to know provision, right to participate in government. A lot of them are your standard rights that are in the U.S. Constitution, you know, the right of suffrage, the right to freedom of assembly. I'm not sure what specifically in the Bill of Rights Chris is referring to. There's a right to organize. I think maybe he's talking more about access to lands. Is that what he's talking about?
I think it's the part, and I don't have it in front of me, the healthful environment. Maybe a bit ill-defined. And I think overall, the question is, you know, Are some of those provisions being maybe misused or abused, and not allowing free commerce as it should be?
Well, that's a good question. There's certainly been a lot of lawsuits regarding that question, and they continue to this day. You've got to remember that that right to a clean and healthful environment was put in the Constitution at a time when a couple things were going on. The Berkeley Pit in Butte, we had pretty messed up air in a lot of communities in the state, especially in western Montana, from the pulp mill in Missoula, the teepee burners up and down from Missoula to the Flathead. And you also had the prospect of coal mining, widespread coal mining.
The way the current Constitution is interpreted by the current, we have elections, we have initiative, and we have the amendments that can be done by the legislature and the people. The people eventually own this Constitution. And if you dislike something, that's the way democracy works. We work our way through it. And there's methods with which we can make change in the Constitution or in our elected officials leading up to change in the Constitution.
Let's get to our preamble here a little bit. And that's an argument I think that we'll maybe expound upon a bit later at another time. I think it's fair. And it's something that, you know, I tend to agree with Chris that intent is being misused at this point. It's hindering. It's hindering lawful, good development in a lot of areas. But here's the preamble. I read it maybe quite hastily going into the break here, but there was a lot of thought, Evan, put into this. And I'm curious about this, even this first statement, "We the people of Montana, grateful to God." Was there debate on that inclusion, grateful to God, in our preamble?
Well, there was, but it's you'll be surprised about what it was. There was not a debate about having God listed at all, to any significant degree. What there was a discussion about that whether they ought to use the word creator rather than God, in somewhat in deference to our Native American population in Montana, to use the word creator. But they decided to use God, and it wasn't a big debate about that. That was the only change in the draft, which was done by Maynard Ellingson and Bob Campbell. They drafted this I think it's a beautiful preamble. It sets the stage and the tone for the document itself. They drafted that, and the only change that was made was a change from creator to God. So they put God in actively instead of creator, but they had an interesting thing. That's the only thing that happened that changed that language at all.
Chuck, your thoughts on our preamble?
I think it's a beautiful piece of writing, and it's interesting to hear. It's quoted quite a bit by people, and I think they did a nice job on it. It sort of expresses the beauty of the state, the mountains to the plains, and I think it does a very nice job.
Here's that text message, 781-627-5483 on the text line. I think this is a clarification, too. Why do lobbying groups, and this is what the call, why do lobbying groups seem to have more power and more say than us legal citizens? It's like they play with a different rule book than a law-abiding citizen does.
Tom?
Yeah?
Before you cut off, I just have to tell you, I had a kind of a little, I'm here at home, I have kind of a little emergency came up, I'm going to have to get off.
Okay, understood, thank you.
I'll leave it with you and Chuck for the rest, and I apologize.
Yeah, no, that's, I hope everything's okay, Evan. Okay. We'll certainly circle back. Chuck, maybe your thoughts on this as well. Just to follow up on that, does this Constitution create and maintain an equal and level playing field?
Well, I guess that's in the eye of the beholder. One thing our Constitution does do, and it actually goes back to the progressive movement in the 1912, 1914 era, is we have initiatives and referendums. And those are put on the ballot by groups of people that get a certain number of signatures spread out around the state, and they can get anything they want on the ballot. They can amend laws. But this constitution gave anyone the power to propose a constitutional initiative for the first time. And we've seen that used as well by both sides, really. The other thing it does that's a pretty unique, I think, to this to constitutions and states is we have an automatic vote every 20 years whether people want to call another constitutional convention. The next vote will be in 2030. So everyone will get a chance to vote. Do you want to call another one? Well, clearly the Constitution is a product of its times, the early 70s. Would it be different if it were written today? Absolutely. It would be different if it were written in 30 years from now? Probably so. So people will have a chance to call a constitutional convention if they wish. They also have a chance to amend the Constitution at any time. It's not easy to do.
Yeah.
You need to have people out there getting signatures, and then you need to pass an initiative, and it's not that hard. But they can do it that way. The legislature can vote by a supermajority to put a call for a constitutional convention on the ballot as well. So there are three different ways to get the Constitution changed.
And I think that was certainly with a lot of purpose and intent to include those kinds of provisions. Hey, if they do call for a new constitutional convention in 2030, would you come out of retirement?
Boy, it'd be fun to do. I know Maynard Ellingson, who was the youngest delegate in the 1972 constitutional convention. I think she was 24. She said if they call another one, she hopes to run again. I hope to cover it. How about that?
That'll be great. That's news for the day, Chuck. Stand by. I do got to take a break, and then we'll come on back. We've got a line open at 866-627-5483 or 781-627-5483 for text messages. It's the 50th celebration of our state constitution here today with Chuck Johnson on Voices of Montana.
Miles Community College, we asked current MCC students why they chose MCC.
Hi, I'm Cruz McNulty, and I chose MCC because I'm on a rodeo scholarship, and they have a wonderful rodeo team.
My name is Carson Hauser, and I chose Miles Community College for the small class sizes and great education.
To learn more about Miles Community College, visit milescc.edu.
Chuck, as we went to break there, there was talk about how it was heavy on citizen involvement, and that carried over to open government, too.
That's right, Tom. Previously, there were a lot of closed meetings, that sort of thing. The legislature's votes on second reading or after the main debate were not recorded. They made some changes that open things up. Those votes are recorded now in all votes. There's a clause in the Bill of Rights that says basically all meetings shall be open to the public, all government meetings, unless the right to individual privacy exceeds the public's right to the disclosure of the information. I will say that one's been subject to many, many lawsuits, and some have gone in favor of the media or citizens that have sued. Some have not, but it's a general openness in the thing. The convention's meetings were open. They didn't have secret caucuses, that sort of thing. So it was definitely a body that believed in openness, and that was definitely different than what the legislature had been like. Executive sessions of committees where they voted whether to kill a bill or keep it alive or amend it, those all used to be closed. Now there's a provision in the Constitution that says all legislative meetings shall be open. I will add that's not always followed to the letter of the constitutional provision, and they've started meeting in quorums, less than quorums. And the Supreme Court recently upheld that, which I think is a step backwards. But in general, it's a document that breathes light into public openness, and that's, I think, in my opinion, that's good. No matter what side you are, you get to hear the arguments and get to watch them vote.
Yeah, and really, I think opened up the entire process to more of the general public as well. We've run out of time in this segment, but Chuck, I want to come on back and talk more because there's a lot of things regarding this Constitution, the history leading up to it and the history behind it, and maybe how quickly it took effect, but women's suffrage and elections, a big part of it, education, public lands, a big part of this too. So will you come on back and chat more with us?
I'd be happy to anytime, Tom.
All right, Chuck. Thank you. And also thanks to Evan Barrett as well. We are in Helena tomorrow. Adam Schieffer is going to interview Victoria Lifshitz from Right on Trek. We've got 41 Grains. We've got Go Roam Free. And we've got the announcement for the Retailer of the Year tomorrow.